Cat listeners, you are listening to Techno for Science. Thanks again for joining me. This is DJ Rooch. As always, kicking off the show with a Parrot, Fractalis Part 1 off his album Walls. Got a lot of good show for you today. I will be having Emily Anthes, a science writer based in Brooklyn, New York, call in. She has a fantastic blog on Floss Blogs and also has a number of really great articles out for anyone to check out. So we'll be chatting with her about all those fun things she's been writing about. Also got a bunch of new music, as usual, so stay tuned for that. Shoot me a call, 415-341-1199. This is Techno for Science. Let's get back to the music. science. Right now you are listening to The Time Writer with Handsome Machine off of his album Soul Stickers. Before that was Gorge with Ona on Mood. Stay tuned, Emily Anthe's coming up in a few minutes.
We'll be right back.
All right, Techno for Science listeners, you're back. This is DJ Rooch. On the line, I have Emily Anthes. Emily, can you hear me?
I can.
Fantastic. Very happy to have Emily on the show. She is a science writer based out of Brooklyn, New York, and also a member of the Public Library of Science Blogging Network, or PLOS Blogs, and is also a writer for a number of different publishing corporations. Emily, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Great. So why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself? I know you're part of the PLOS Blog Networks, but how did you get into science writing? What's your background? You know, where did you kind of get the idea for what kind of work you want to do for your blog?
It seems like a long story at the time, but in retrospect, it seems like a short story. I was always interested in science. I was a science fair geek in high school, and in particular, I was interested in neuroscience. And so when I went off to college, I was planning to study neuroscience and, you know, thinking about going to med school and either doing research or, you know, clinical work in the field of neuroscience. But as I took more and more science classes, I discovered that I really liked learning about science, but I didn't actually like doing it. I wasn't very good at labs, and I didn't really enjoy that work. So I'd always also been interested in journalism. Both my parents are journalists, and was just sort of had always done that as a hobby. And when I was a junior in college, I met someone who called themselves a science writer, and, you know, the proverbial light bulb went off. It hadn't even occurred to me that there were people out there that did science writing for a living. And as soon as I heard about it, I realized that was the perfect way to combine my interest in journalism with sort of my intellectual interest in science, and also let me be a little bit ADD, where instead of having to go into research and specialize in some small area, I could write about the brain one week and an octopus the next week and sort of skip around whatever science stories interested me. So I sort of knew right out of college that I wanted to pursue science writing, and worked away for a couple years as a freelancer, just pitching stories here and there. And this summer got an email from Brian Mossup, who, you know, said that PLOS was starting up this blog network, and they liked my work and did I want to be a part of it. And blogging had always been something that interested me, and so I was definitely, you know, eager to accept the invitation, but I also found it a little scary. I'd never blogged before because I didn't know how to get started. I didn't know if I would have enough to say. And
that seems to be, I don't know, from my perspective, is there really that much to write about? But there is.
There's tons, and actually I confess that my problem isn't coming up with ideas. I have lists full of ideas. It's finding the time to actually give them the attention that I think they deserve. Stuff I'd like to write about, but sometimes it's hard to find the time to sit down and put a coherent sentence together about it.
Yeah, so I just want to remind listeners that the blog is Wonderland on PLOS Blogs. So Wonderland was your first foray into blogging. Before that, it was all magazine pieces?
Yeah, newspapers. I did a lot of newspaper work. And I'd done one or two. I worked at Seed Magazine for a while, and I'd done a couple guest posts on blogs at Seed, but I'd never blogged for any lengthy period of time. And I wasn't sure I'd be any good at it, because I'm kind of a perfectionist, and I thought, how can I send something out into the world that hasn't been seen by three editors? But I think it's been good for me to practice sort of writing fast.
And a lot of your writing has been neuroscience-focused, and what was your approach to Wonderland? So what would you say that Wonderland is about?
That's something I struggled with a lot, because I read a lot of science blogs even before I had a science blog, and it seemed like some of the most successful ones had a pretty defined focus. You know, it was a scientist writing about a particular field, or a journalist writing about pharmaceutical drugs, or women's health, or climate change. And so I thought about concentrating on neuroscience, but my interests are really diverse, and I kept thinking, well, what if there's a really cool story I want to write about and it doesn't fit in my neuroscience purview? And eventually I just decided to embrace the wide array of interests that I had. And so I started thinking of the blog as, I think I call it online at some point, a virtual curiosity cabinet, just a place to collect cool and interesting scientific tidbits. And I am interested in psychology and neuroscience, so a lot of the things I write about are in that field, but I've written about ecology and all sorts of other little interesting tidbits that I stumble across.
Awesome. Yeah, one of my favorite parts of the blog is Small Wonders, where you kind of just scour the blogosphere and the science journalism world for just cute little stories.
Right, and, you know, every Friday, as you say, I have this feature called Small Wonders, and it's just essentially a link roundup, but I realized pretty early on that there were more cool things happening in science than I could ever possibly write about.
Yeah.
And, you know, if someone was just checking in for interesting, almost cocktail party tidbits, that I would just provide a series of links that people could explore on their own. So that's fun to put together every week.
Fantastic. Well, let's jump into some of the fun stuff that you've been writing about. I am, of course, and as are many of your fans, excited to hear about the alcohol and reptiles connection that you've uncovered diligently.
Yes.
So we can start there, but of course, let's, you know, talk about anything that you want to highlight. But let's start with this alcohol-reptile connection. How did this start, and how did it kind of evolve into what it is now?
Yeah, I totally intended it to just be a one-off post. I read a lot of journals and medical literature, and actually my degree in college was in the history of science, and so that's something I'm really interested in. And so I spend a lot of time just browsing through new abstracts and various journals, and you know, I'm always grabbed by something that looks at some historical scientific development. And I don't even remember how I found this abstract, but in perusing various journals, I came across this abstract that was the most interesting, compelling abstract I think I had ever seen. Often you have to sort of parse the abstract and figure out what's really going on and could there be a story here. But in this case, the story just grabbed me right from the abstract. And the gist of it was that this man at the London Zoo in the 19th century had too much to drink, and he had been bitten by a cobra and died. And, you know, the abstract was short on details, but that was enough to sell me on the story. So I went and got the full text, and there were a couple things that grabbed me about it. One was just the ridiculous nature of the story. This guy who gets drunk and works at the zoo and starts manhandling a cobra just seemed like a natural sort of humorous situation, not for him, but for readers today.
Yes.
And the other thing was that the paper was written with such exquisite, almost poetic detail. It was understated and just lovely to read, which not a lot of scientific papers are. So I decided to put up a short little post about it, and post was mainly an excerpt from the paper because I thought I couldn't do it justice. It had already been written so well, and it got a huge response. People loved it. It, you know, went viral. I guess I didn't expect that, but in retrospect, I can see why it caught people's attention, and that was sort of the end of that, or so I thought. It was an interesting story, but, you know, not part of some larger scientific trend.
So there is where I thought it was the funniest, and I think maybe that's why it spoke to so many people, is because, like, for me, yes, it's hilarious, but two, it's also hilarious that it could still happen today. The idea that drunk idiots are doing the same thing they've been doing for hundreds of years just kind of tickles me, you know?
Yep, and you always hear about all the things you're not supposed to do while drunk, like operating heavy machinery or driving, and you can imagine not wanting to show up at your manufacturing job drunk. But here was this ridiculous idea that zookeeping is probably another job you don't want to show up drunk to.
Indeed. And, I think there was one sentence
that many people think about.
Yes. There was one sentence, I don't know if I got that from your post or somewhere else, that he had wrapped it around himself like a belt.
Like a what? I'm sorry.
Like a belt.
Oh, yes, yes. he actually, first he was with some friend of his, co-zookeeper, and he wrapped it around his friend, who, being more sober, understandably freaked out and told him to put the snake away, and then he got the cobra out and decided he would wrap it around himself. I think he had it like a scarf and then like a belt, and the cobra came up sort of through his jacket and bit him in the face.
Amazing. And, amazing.
I guess the paper was ostensibly to talk about this historical use of anesthesia and some other medical interventions, and it talks about how they unsuccessfully tried to revive him. But I, of course, was not interested in that so much as the story of how this guy got in this situation.
Definitely. Okay, so it went a little bit viral, and then there were follow-ups.
Yes. There was a great story that I think National Geographic ran and got picked up by some other places a few weeks after that about these lizards in Vietnam, and a new species of lizard had been discovered. And what instantly struck me about this story was, it's always interesting when scientists discover a new species, but usually it's because they go to some remote patch of jungle, or these days they're going deep to the ocean floor, places humans haven't been before, and finding strange life. But in this case, they found a new species of lizard in a restaurant. They were being served in a Vietnamese restaurant. And so instantly, those are the sorts of things I love to cover in my blog. They have a science angle, but there also is some quirky fact that makes them stand out. And that was just perfect sort of thing, I thought, for a blog post.
Yeah.
And as I delved deeper into the story, I found that the man who discovered these lizards had called some researchers who had special knowledge of lizards and species to come and evaluate them. And the researchers had to fly to Vietnam, and they showed up at the restaurant, and it turns out by the time they had gotten there, some man had basically had a drunken party and ordered lizards for the table, and they were all gone. They had all been eaten.
Oh, my goodness.
So you can imagine these guys who have gotten on the plane and flown here for what they think is going to be a
scientific discovery,
and they've been eaten. And fortunately, the lizards were fairly common in the area, and they were able to hire some locals to rustle up some more lizards, and it did turn out that they were, in fact, a previously undescribed species, which I think is one of the remarkable parts of the story, that here they are just being served in a restaurant, so common that they're basically foodstuffs, and yet science had never described them before. They were totally unknown to science. And so that story wasn't... Alcohol wasn't the main point of that story, but obviously when I got to the detail of the drunk man and I started to type up the post, it struck me that this was the second post in a month that had somehow combined the idea of reptiles and alcohol. And I don't do so many posts, and I realized that was a strange beat to be covering, but I thought I would embrace it, I suppose.
Absolutely.
And I guess the final chapter, at least so far in the story, was shortly after that post went up, I got an email from Mark Abrahams, who I guess you and some people may know as the editor of the Annals of Improbable Research, the organization that gives out the Ig Nobel Prizes every year for research that's real but sort of quirky or strange or ridiculous. And he said, well, if you want to expand your beat from alcohol and reptiles to alcohol and amphibians, I've got this great study for you. And he attached this amazing study from the 70s of a graduate student who was in Costa Rica and decided that he was going to do a taste test of local tadpoles. So here was this paper published in a peer-reviewed journal in which a small group of human subjects tried all these different kinds of tadpoles and rated them to see which tasted the best.
Just taste them, like they would taste all these tadpoles.
Yes, and the one of the things that caught my eye and that I describe more in the blog is it's a scientific paper, so you have to be very precise. And so he gives these wonderful, very specific descriptions for how he instructed people to eat these tadpoles.
Amazing.
So they had to clean out their mouths with water before each tadpole. First they had to hold them in their mouth to just sort of get the taste of the skin. Then they were instructed to slowly bite down on the tail. It was this very elaborate procedure.
It's like fine wine. You know, there's a way to do it right.
Exactly. And I thought it was great, but I scoured the paper. I didn't see any mention of alcohol in it. So I wrote Mark back and said, I'd love to write about this paper. I'm going to do it anyway. But you said it has something to do with alcohol. And he wrote back and told me it turns out that this guy who did the study was a graduate student, and his subjects were basically his fellow graduate students down in Costa Rica with him. And he encouraged them to participate by buying them beer. So that was the alcohol connection. but it actually was an interesting little paper. And
so what was the purpose? Why were they doing taste tests?
Right. That was an obvious question one might ask. And turns out they were using humans as what they refer to in the paper as the mock predator. And so they tasted 5 different species of tadpoles. And the question was, among these 5 different species, some of the tadpoles were very well camouflaged. They were small, or they blended into the environment, or they hid under rocks and other things in streams, where other species were totally conspicuous and seemed to be ripe for the taking for any predators in the area. And so the researcher wondered whether the tadpoles that were right out in the open, maybe they could survive that way because they didn't taste good. And the tadpoles, perhaps, that were hiding had a lot of pressure to evolve camouflage because they were the best-tasting favorite tadpoles for the local predators. And so that seemed like a reasonable hypothesis, but I guess, it's hard to get a bear and ask them which tadpole tastes best.
Indeed.
So you have to do it with humans, and he says in the paper that the assumption is that some aspects of taste might transfer across species, and so humans might be a suitable mock predator for this experiment. And he actually found some evidence for that hypothesis, that by and large, the best-tasting tadpoles were the ones that were the best camouflage, and developed the best defenses against predation. I don't know how.
Oh, that's pretty interesting. Yeah, that's
yeah,
neat. I mean, you would assume that's how, natural selection would work, but I am surprised that it worked in humans and not actual predators.
Right, and he talks in the paper, I guess there have been some previous studies that showed that human taste might be loosely mirror what you find in other species, but that's not always true. There was research recently that showed that, cats don't have the ability to detect sweet things, so I guess it depends on the species, but
definitely.
Just an interesting little piece of research that makes you laugh and also makes you think, and those are the things that I love to cover it over at Wonderland.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful blog, and again, everybody should check it out. It's at PLOS Blogs, and the name of it is Wonderland. So we could obviously spend the rest of the hour discussing Wonderland posts, but I do want to cover some other things that you've been working on. I know you have a lot of projects going on outside of PLOS Blogs. Do you want to talk about anything recent that you wrote?
Sure. I mean, one of the stories that I guess got a lot of attention and I got a lot of feedback on was a piece I wrote for the ideas section of the Boston Globe about bullying, which most of your listeners probably know has been in the news a lot lately. There have been stories about teens who have committed suicide or, other tragedies caused by bullying, and online bullying has made this an even more prominent facet of the media these days. And so it's not news to anyone that bullying is bad. I mean, we have these tragedies to prove it, and anyone with half a brain realizes that bullying is a bad thing. But what the story talks about is the emergence of, for the first few studies, and again, this is a new field of inquiry, so it's pretty preliminary, but researchers are beginning to look at bullying in the brain. So we know that bullying has all these effects on behavior. It can cause kids who are bullied to show up to school less. It can cause depression. It can cause anxiety, all those other things we normally think about. And researchers are now beginning to say, well, what's the mechanism? And can being teased be doing something to the brain itself? And what's remarkable about some of these studies is that they're not, for the most part, looking at physical abuse. These aren't kids who are being beaten by their peers or, you know, hit on the head with beer bottles. It's purely emotional and verbal abuse. And indeed, the first few studies are showing that that kind of emotional and verbal abuse can cause distinct changes in the brain. And so far, what it looks like is that these changes are the same kinds of changes that happen when a kid is physically abused by a parent or sexually abused by a stranger, that bullying and teasing by peers is part of the same continuum of abuse.
What's the age group?
Of a new way of looking at bullying, I think.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. What's the age group?
Go ahead.
What are the age groups of the studies that you looked into for this article? When are they taking these brain measurements and imaging?
Sure. Well, the actual brain imaging, there has not been a whole lot of it yet, but mostly we're talking about middle school kids, 7th, 8th grade, and on the one study that's been done, the scans were of those brains, but there are also, some of these studies have also been done retrospectively, so you're actually scanning the brain of young adults, people who are maybe 25, and asking them about their bullying history. So it's not a perfect measurement because it's subject to some recall and asking people to report how much they were bullied and looking at their brains as adults, but it's the start of this field of inquiry. And I talked to some researchers who study teens who are hoping to do more imaging in the future over the course of years in which teens or children are bullied to see how those changes happen and if, you know, what the lag is and if they last into adulthood. There are a lot of unanswered questions, but
yeah,
sort of the beginning of a new area of inquiry.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the main conclusions of at least the preliminary studies?
Well, the most recent study that's been done on human brains looks in particular at an area of the brain called the corpus callosum, and that's a thick bundle of fibers that connects the right hemisphere of the brain to the left hemisphere of the brain. And, you know, the brain's, the hemispheres work a little bit differently, but it's vital that they work together in concert. And it's the corpus callosum that's responsible for communicating between the two hemispheres and making sure the brain's working as one whole. And the study found that teens that had been bullied by their peers had some abnormalities in the corpus callosum. They had essentially what the researchers call it is reduced connectivity. And what that means is that the myelin, or the fatty layer that coats neurons, is not as well developed. And myelin helps nerve signals move faster throughout the brain. So essentially what is happening is that messages might be moving slower between the hemispheres of the brain in kids who have been bullied. And we're not sure exactly what behavioral effects that might have, but it could be subtle things like decreases in processing speed, particularly important in visual processing. So there are some ideas that it might cause some sort of cognitive slowing, even subtle cognitive slowing, but it's not quite clear yet exactly how. And one of the other interesting things is that studies that have been done on childhood abuse by parents or sexual abuse, sort of the more physical things that we think of as really abuse, as opposed to bullying, which we don't always think of that way, they've those other kinds of abuse also seem to cause changes in this same bundle of fibers, the corpus callosum. So it's sort of showing that bullying is part of this same
general abuse effects. And you mentioned cyberbullying. Are there any indication of people? It's so new, but you know, a lot of at the psychological level, not necessarily the neural level yet, people are showing very similar things with, you know, online social networks as real world social networks in terms of benefits and deficits. And
right.
Are there, I mean, people have started looking at cyberbullying effects, and I mean, I guess it's really hard to find people that report that they're being cyberbullied, but
there are no studies that have been published yet that I know of in terms of neurological effects of cyberbullying, but the studies that are out there now about emotional and verbal abuse are pretty suggestive, and researchers think that how this is happening is, even though a bully or a kid at school might never lay a hand on you, if they call you names and they make fun of you, that's stressing you out. And the body's response to stress is particularly the increased amounts of cortisol, which is a stress hormone, are causing all sorts of changes in the brain. That's one of the theories for how this mechanism is working. And so you could imagine that cyberbullying causes the same reaction. If it's stressful, if it's emotionally painful, then one would think it would cause the same changes in cortisol and potentially the same sorts of brain changes. That's a little bit speculative now, but it would seem to make sense, and I think we'll start to see more of that. Some of the studies that have been done recently are about people who are now 25 and 30 being bullied 20 years ago, 10 years ago, and so cyberbullying wasn't really a phenomenon then, but I would imagine we'll start seeing more studies on that.
Absolutely. So where was this published again? This was the Boston Globe?
Yes, this story was in the Boston Globe, and it talks about a couple of recent studies.
Awesome. Well, I think that's it for the interview. That's all the time I have right now to talk to you, unfortunately. But thanks so much for coming on.
Sure, no problem. I'm honored to be here.
No, it's been fun. And again, everyone can go check out EmilyAnthes.com. That's Emily, EmilyAnthes.com. And you can see all of her work and get links to the blog. So, Emily, thanks again, and hope to have you on again soon.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, this is Techno for Science. Thanks again, Emily, for coming on. Very interesting stuff. I got a little bit more time, so let's get back to the music. Yeah.
last of all, try to reach me. When you lie here beneath me, shadows falling on the walls, catch the moment as it falls. Down below you lose
That's it for this week's Techno for Science. Thanks everyone for tuning in. Thanks to Emily Anthes for calling in. You're listening to Robert Babich, Out of Order on Immortal Chains. Before that was John Tejada with Everything Will Be Okay on Logic Memory Center. I'll see you all next week. Techno for Science, Pirate Cat Radio, www.piratecatradio.com. Stop in the cafe at 21st and Florida, beautiful Mission District of San Francisco. Catch y'all next week.
This is La Ninja Maria of the Deviant Ninja Show, giving you the Pirate Cat Radio weekly calendar for interviews and performances for the week of December 6, 2010. Here's what's happening in the cafe on the corner of Florida and 21st Streets in San Francisco. Sunday, December 12th at 11 a.m., the Phonographic Funhouse will feature Peggy Ray and Mama Crow. At 1 p.m., the Bulkin' Vulcan Show will feature the storyteller Fred Parks. At 3 p.m., Sanguine Soul will have guest DJ Tomo. And at 6 p.m., Shay's Kitchen will be featuring Big Lion. On Nocturna at 8 p.m., check out a performance by Dead to Me and an interview with Isolated Victims. There you go. That's the calendar for interviews and performances at Pirate Cat Radio for the week of December 6, 2010. Check out the Pirate Cat Cafe at the corner of 21st Streets in Florida in the Mission District of San Francisco. Hey, mark your calendars. Monday, December 13th for the Pirate Cat Radio presents The Holiday Show at the Milk Bar located at 1840 Haight Street featuring performances by The Famous, Private Idaho, Barrel Riders, Magnetisme Cultura, and other Pirate Cat Radio DJs. The doors open at 8 p.m. And don't forget, you guys, listen to me, La Ninja Maria, every Saturday from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. on the Deviant Ninja Show.
Welcome back to another edition of New Music at Pirate Cat Radio. I am your music director, Catherine. The first track I have for you today is coming out of Germany. This track is by shareholder Tom. It's called Stopover Abeokuta. It's the Sosu Soul Complex remix, and you can find it on the new album Havana Asmara Via Colonia, out on Borough 9 Music. Again, the name of that band is Shareholder Tom. Now we're going to jump on over to England. This track is called Resolution, and it's a new track out by Gang of Four. Gang of Four album out on Yep Rock Records. For the last track of the day, we are going to bring it back to America. We're going to bring it back to Kentucky. This track is by Englishman and it's called Angels and Earthworms. I hope you've enjoyed the selection of new music here at Pirate Cat Radio.
Thought I should tell you.